Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, I'm joined by Dr. Nazgul Gandnoush, co-director of research with the Sentencing Project, to discuss a new report of which she's co-author, entitled Incarceration and Crime, A Weak Relationship. But first, on Wednesday, July 10th, the U.S. Senate passed H.R. 3019, the Federal Prison Oversight Act. The House passed the measure back in May, so it now goes to the president's desk for signature. Here's the lead sponsor in the Senate, Senator John Ossoff of Georgia.
How did it come to pass that in a nation whose founding document guarantees due process and civil rights and prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, a federal prison in Dublin, California, would become so notorious for the endemic sexual abuse of female inmates by prison staff that it would be known as Rape Club? Rape Club. Sexual assault and abuse of federal inmates by the warden, by the chaplain. Senator Johnson of Wisconsin and I led a bipartisan investigation of sexual assault in federal prisons. We found that in two-thirds of federal prisons that housed female inmates, inmates had been sexually assaulted by members of prison staff. We found that at the U.S. Penitentiary in Atlanta, in my home state of Georgia, for nearly a decade, unchecked corruption and civil rights abuses had been ongoing with the knowledge of the leadership of the Bureau of Prisons, and no effective action had been taken to address them. Pretrial detainees sleeping in paper pajamas, denied access to counsel, denied access to hygiene products, denied access to fresh air. Pre-trial, presumptively innocent federal detainees. The human rights crisis behind bars in the United States is a stain on America's conscience. And Mr. President, we just passed the most significant federal prison reform legislation in many years. And now it's on the way to the desk of the President of the United States. I am grateful to my colleague, Senator Braun of Indiana, for joining me in authoring and introducing the Federal Prison Oversight Act, which has now been passed by the Senate and the House. This is landmark prison reform legislation. It will require the Inspector General of the Department of Justice to undertake ongoing and regular inspections of every single federal prison in the United States. It will establish an independent ombudsman at the Department of Justice to investigate the health, safety, welfare, and rights of incarcerated people and staff, who will also create a secure hotline and an online form for family members, friends, and representatives of incarcerated Americans to submit complaints and inquiries. It will require the IG to report the findings from its routine inspections of federal prisons and recommendations to Congress and to the public, and require the Bureau of Prisons to respond to all inspection reports within 60 days with a corrective action plan. We were able to pass this legislation because we worked together, Senator Johnson and I, leading multiple bipartisan investigations of human rights abuses and corruption in the federal prison system. Senator Braun and I forming the Prison Policy Working Group to develop bipartisan solutions like this one. I'm grateful to my colleague from Georgia in the U.S. House, Representative McBath, for her tireless efforts to shepherd this bill to passage in the U.S. House. And today we passed it on the floor of the Senate. I'm grateful for the support of my colleagues. And let the leadership of the Bureau of Prisons know that the United States Congress will no longer tolerate the wanton and ongoing and widespread abuse of those who are in their custody.
That was Senator John Ossoff speaking on the Senate floor on Wednesday, July 10th. So the Federal Prison Oversight Act now goes to the president's desk for a signature. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now from a conversation with Dr. Nazgul Gandnoush, co-director of research with the Sentencing Project and co-author of a new report from the Sentencing Project entitled Incarceration and Crime, A Weak Relationship.
So I'm Nazgul Gandnoush, co-director of research at the Sentencing Project. And in this role, I work with my colleagues to synthesize research that others do, especially in academic settings, and conduct our own research to help people understand how we can move towards reducing incarceration levels, reducing racial disparities, and advancing community safety in more effective and less harmful ways.
Could you tell us a bit about the Sentencing Project?
Sure. The Sentencing Project has been around for over 35 years. We're a DC-based nonprofit organization, and our work is national. So we do research and advocacy in support of criminal justice reform in the areas of extreme sentencing, juvenile justice or youth justice, voting rights, and to advance racial justice as well in the criminal legal system. And so we work in particular states and conduct research that's tailored to the needs of advocates and policymakers in particular states and at the federal level. And we also do a lot of surveys of what's going on nationwide in terms of trends in incarceration levels, trends in extreme sentencing, and so on, so that states have a sense of whether they're outliers, whether they're leaders or falling back in terms of reforming the problems in the criminal legal system.
Well, so now let's get to your new report, which again, for the benefit of listeners, is entitled Incarceration and Crime, A Weak Relationship. Tell me about this.
This is a report that updates one that we did over a decade ago. And we received some requests to actually update the figures in that report so that people have a better sense of this issue. And it's really timely in a way, because what's happened in incarceration in the United States is that starting in 2010, after over 30 years of the prison population going up, the prison population finally started to decline. And it declined for a little over 10 years. And the decline has been really modest in incarceration levels, but some states have really done quite a lot in reducing their prison populations. And I can get into that those details later in terms of who's a leader in decarceration. But we saw that in 2022, the prison population actually increased. And so that's a really unfortunate trend to see, because until then, our organization and many others had been encouraging policymakers to lean more heavily into decarceration, to move away from mass incarceration. And we had not yet done enough to chip away at that. And yet we see the trend starting to reverse. And part of the reason for that is because the prison population came down considerably in 2020 because of COVID, because of reduced admissions to prisons in that year. And that was a 14% reduction in the prison population in that year. But, you know, just keep in mind that when I talk about these percentages and when I say that, you know, between 2009 and 2021, the prison population came down overall 25%, That's after a nearly 700% buildup in the prison population since 1972. So we, again, are just barely chipping away at this mass incarceration problem that we've created over the last couple of decades. But so as things opened up after, in the later stages of the COVID pandemic, prisons opened up again, admissions went up again. And rather than maintaining the lower levels of incarceration, the numbers started to increase. And at the same time, what's happened during the COVID pandemic is that some crime rates went up, and in particular, the worst crime, homicide rates, started to increase and really spike during the pandemic. And so policymakers started to get cold feet about criminal justice reform. And even the ones who, some of them who had been advancing scaling back incarceration levels in many different parts of the country, are now talking about increasing prison terms, increasing prison admissions. And so this is a report that's really targeted towards that argument of, well, we did a bit, and maybe it's time to pause, and maybe it's time to roll back. And the response is, no, we have not done enough, and it's definitely not time to pause and roll back the reforms that were implemented in the last decade or so.
It seems clear to me in reading your report, you laid out quite well, but why is it that mass incarceration has failed so badly to improve public safety? I mean, it really has made it worse.
Yeah, that's a great question. So when you look at incarceration levels in the US and you see that they went up in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, what you see is that during that period of time, crime was going up some of that time. Up until the 1990s, crime rates were going up. And then since the 1990s, crime rates have been going down. And yet we continue to increase incarceration levels, even as crime rates were going down. So you could look at that combination of trends and wonder, well, seems like regardless of what happens with crime, we've been increasing incarceration levels, right? And so that's the argument of the title. There's a weak relationship between crime and incarceration. A lot of the policies that we've developed around incarceration are not closely linked to what happens in crime trends. And that's because the way that mass incarceration happens is through a couple different mechanisms, through policymakers and practitioners like prosecutors deciding to impose se prison sentences more often than they had in the past for similar behavior. So, whereas selling drugs might have, in the past, in before the 1970s, not gotten you into prison, or maybe given you a probation sentence, now it's more likely to get you into prison. And the second factor is that contributes to mass incarceration is that not only are people going to prison more often for things that they didn't go to prison for before, or that they might have gotten community supervision for, when they are sent to prison, they're kept much longer than in the past. Prison sentences have gotten much longer. So when we look at trends of crime and incarceration at the state level, or if we even look at this internationally, we can see that as you increase incarceration levels, it doesn't necessarily bring down crime levels. And there are a lot of measurements that criminologists have done to try to figure out how much has mass incarceration contributed to the crime drop that's happened since the 1990s. And what they find is that it's rather limited. It made a roughly 25% contribution to the crime drop that happened early on in that period. But then after that, it didn't make any contribution to the crime drop. And in fact, when you look at other countries, as I was mentioning, what you see is that many other countries experienced the same uptick in crime in the 70s and 80s, and then a downturn starting in the 1990s. But the United States is the only country that decided to address that with mass incarceration that increased its prison population by 700%. Other countries didn't dramatically change their incarceration levels, and yet their crime rates came down. And that's because crime is a much more complicated issue that and incarceration just chips away at a very small part of it. So in the report, we include what's commonly called a criminal justice funnel, which shows that only a small proportion of crime that actually happens, and we focus on violent crime, only a small proportion of victimizations are actually reported to the police. A small proportion of those reports result in an arrest. A small proportion of those arrests result in a conviction, and a smaller proportion of those result in a prison or jail sentence. So incarceration is really taking a very, addressing a very small slice of the crime that actually is happening in our communities. And that's typical. That's not something that we can change. It's just how it works. People, for a variety of reasons, don't report their crimes. There's only so much that can happen to actually arrest somebody, have that lead to a conviction. So we can only expect so much from incarceration. And there's so much else that we need to be doing as a society to prevent victimization from happening in the first place. This is a limited tool that we're using. And so, so just to wrap up in response to your question of why is incarceration community or contributing so little, it has to do partly with the fact that it's, actually able to impact a small number of cases. But even in those cases, even in those instances where someone gets locked up, you have to think about, well, if it's a group of people that are committing a crime, or if it's a group of people selling drugs, let's say if you lock someone up for selling drugs, there's what's called a replacement effect. Someone else will come and fill in that role. When it comes to long sentences, it's also really important to understand that what we're doing is getting people at the time that they're engaged in criminal activity, and a lot of times holding them behind bars for decades after they no longer pose a threat to the community safety. And yet we're still incarcerating them. And that produces very, very limited public safety benefit to incarcerating people like that.
This is my conversation with Nazgul Gandnoush, PhD, co-director of research with the Sentencing Project. We're discussing a new report from the Sentencing Project entitled Incarceration and Crime, A Weak Relationship. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. You mentioned earlier that over the last decade in particular, some states have taken steps to reduce the number of people they imprison, whether it's court order or some legislator actually, I don't know, started thinking clearly. Could you, how did that, how's that, how's that working out?
So, when we look at the peak year of incarceration of the prison population in the United States, that was 2009. And the best data that we have for now is that since that time, there's been a 25% reduction in the prison population. So that's where we are overall in terms of big picture. But again, we're at this really critical moment right now where we'll either continue to move towards decarceration, or there are a lot of doubts of do we want to actually change paths, change course. And so that's, really to be determined. And one of the things that we try to highlight in this report is that if you look at the state level, you can see that actually nearly all states, when we decided to look at a period of time from 2013 to 2022, during that period of time, nearly all states have reduced their prison populations. And it's actually just all but three states, Nebraska, North Dakota, Montana, have reduced their prison populations. For some, like Arkansas, Idaho, it's been a 1% reduction in their prison population during that period. So hardly anything. But for some, like Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Alabama, even, it's been a 40% or more reduction in the prison population. So, really substantial, and still a long way to go, certainly in all of those states, but really substantial decarceration in some of these states that are leaders in decarceration. At the same time that states have been reducing their prison populations, almost every state nationwide, crime rates have been falling. And so that's a really important fact for people to know, that the 10-year period, roughly between 2013 and 2022, is a period of time that 46 states have reduced their prison population and reduced crime levels at the same time. And I think that's something that should really strengthen people's resolve, that We need to continue to lean into decarceration. This is a period of time that clearly many states have reduced incarceration levels and still experience the positive benefits of crime rates coming down.
What can be done? I mean, strike that. What should be done? What do state and federal lawmakers need to be doing?
Well, one thing is to continue to pursue policies that, with respect to drugs, advance a public health approach instead of a criminalization approach, and making sure that as we make those transitions towards an alternative public health approach, like Measure 10 was trying to do, that we really fully fund those efforts so that they're able to deliver what we're hoping for, and that we give those policies time to succeed. You know, we've been giving mass incarceration plenty of time, even though it's harming our communities, even though there's so much evidence that it's contributing very little to community safety. And yet when it comes to reforms, we tend to be very impatient. So yeah, Measure 110 in Oregon, New York's reversal of its bail reform law, Louisiana going back to re-embracing its draconian prison sentences. These are all examples of the move in the wrong direction. And so we really want to empower people who are interested in this issue to recognize that when policymakers are calling for going back to criminalization and mass incarceration as a way to solve the problems that we face, and indeed there are some serious problems that we're facing. We still have an overdose death crisis. We still have a lot of homelessness in many parts of our country. We still have, we're still undoing the spikes that happened with respect to homicide during the pandemic, though things seem to be calming down. But even still, homicide levels are higher than they are. These kinds of suggestions, these kinds of policy proposals are not fixing those problems. They're political theatrics that might win people votes, but they're not actually keeping our communities safer. So what we need to do instead is to rely on solutions outside of the justice system that can tackle these bigger issues. So that includes making sure that everyone has access to effective drug treatment at the moment that they're ready to receive it. Making sure that we have supervised consumption sites to prevent overdose deaths. With respect to violence, we need to really dramatically scale up violence interruption programs. We need to think about crisis intervention that doesn't involve police contact. And then with respect to criminal justice reform, we need to continue to scale back sentence lengths. And that's something that we really push for as an organization, for people to realize that when it comes to ending mass incarceration, ending the drug war is not enough. We still have a long way to go to end the drug war, but it's roughly 18% of the prison population is there for a drug offense as their most serious offense. More than half of the prison population has a violent conviction. And so we really need to look at, when it comes to crimes like assault, robbery, sexual violence, murder, these are crimes that we generally agree, many people agree, someone should be in prison for, but really we need to have the discussion about for how long. When criminologists show us that after 10 years, most people age out of criminal activity, why are we incarcerating so many people beyond that 10-year mark? And how can we get to a point of having a second look at sentences starting at the 10-year mark? So those are some of the solutions that we advocate for.
What have I not yet asked that I should have?
Let me tell you a bit about racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And recently, we put out a series of publications, and the title of those publications, of that series, was 1 in 5. And that 1 in 5 number is about the lifetime likelihood that a young Black man will go to prison at current rates of incarceration. So 1 in 5 young Black men will experience imprisonment, not even a jail sentence, but a prison sentence of a year or longer within their lifetime if we continue going at the rates that we're currently at. And it's important to recognize that that number is first tragically high, that we have a long way still to go to reduce the harmful levels of incarceration that people of color, and particularly Black men, experience in our society. But the other thing to recognize is that that number actually represents progress. 20 years ago, if when researchers were doing that calculation, it was one in three young Black men were expected to go to prison within their lifetime. So within a generation, we've made a lot of progress. And that's come through a lot of different policies that have scaled back police contact with people of color, that have begun to scale back extreme sentences, that have looked at issues like bail reform, looking at issues such as parole reform in some places. So there's a lot that's gone on. But again, like with the trends in incarceration levels, the trends with racial disparities are really fragile. The progress that's been made is fragile. And some of the proposals that we're seeing now, like reverting to criminalizing drug use and sales instead of trying to use a public health approach, you know, more draconian sentences or undoing bail reform, all of these are policies that will disproportionately disadvantage Black Americans and other people of color that are impacted most by the criminal legal system. So I think it's really important to remember, and there's been some research that's been done by this, that the more people in our society associate crime with people of color, the more likely they are to support punitive policies. The more you think of crime as something that is committed by white Americans, the more likely you are actually to support crime prevention programs, programs to help people rehabilitate. So it's really important to think about the role of bias in how we detect threat and what level of, you know, threat we think we are facing in our society. And secondly, what solutions we come up with and try to really mitigate the impact of bias in terms of the solutions that we support.
Any closing thoughts for the listener?
I think, you know, I would like people to just make sure to remember that we've made a lot of progress in since 2010 in reducing incarceration levels, in reducing racial disparities, in moving towards a more humane, less carceral response to the problems in our society. And so this is really, you know, a pivotal moment as we think about how some problems flared up during the pandemic, some really serious problems when it comes to the uptick in homicides. And we really need to maintain our resolve in sticking to what the evidence is, that we incarcerate people at much higher rates than other industrialized countries for much longer periods of time. And we have to achieve two goals now. We have to continue to decarcerate and at the same time pursue other approaches to advancing community safety, approaches that don't rely as heavily on policing and prisons and will be much more effective ultimately in achieving our shared goals.
That was my conversation with Nazgul Gandnoush, PhD, co-director of research with the Sentencing Project. We were discussing a new report from the Sentencing Project entitled Incarceration and Crime, A Weak Relationship, which you can find at their website, sentencingproject.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.